Crumb.
Game prepared for us. Are we ready?
I love games. Yeah.
All right. This is a fun game. Here, I've got a handful of blindfolds that we need to put on. Okay.
Okay. My eyes are covered.
Do I wear it above my mask or below my mask?
Put it right over your eyes.
Okay.
Over the eyes, and the mask goes over your nose. Okay.
Right.
It's not like wearing your pants down below your butt. You gotta have it covered. So you guys get these on and let me know when you're ready.
All right.
I'm ready. Can't see anything.
I can't. Yeah, it's hard. I can't see anything.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm going to have to.
Can I hold your hand?
Of course.
Okay. Let me reach back over here. I got to get my I've got this basket here. I've got it covered with another one of these handkerchiefs. Let me pull the handkerchief off. Wait, I need to get it across my eyes. All right. Now I can't see. I had Liz put this item in the basket, so we're all playing blind here. I don't know necessarily what it is, but I'm gonna hold it here. It feels like it's like woolen, maybe? I don't know. I don't know. Here, I'm gonna
taste it. Did you look?
No,
I mean, I can't see.
I have a thing about textures.
Here, John, you take it.
Okay.
All right.
Is it squishy or
touch it?
Are you cheating?
I'm not. I have my eyes covered.
Wait here.
All right, you take a turn. Yeah. I don't know what.
What is this? It's kind of damp.
You don't know what any of this is?
No, it's a mystery to me.
Where did it come from?
This basket?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
That seems ominous.
I don't really remember either.
I guess
sitting here with you guys in front of this fire with whatever this is, and it's, dudes, it's moving.
Well, I remember awaking, and then there was this basket on the kitchen table,
ready for
our party. What does it feel like, Josh?
It's kind of clammy. It's got these two squishy parts up front, and I think this is a nose.
Oh my god! And can we take our?
It's a head.
Oh my god!
It's moving.
All right. I feel like that was pretty good.
That was excellent.
That was great.
Our improv has come a long way since season one.
It's all the better because it's just totally silly improv.
That's right.
You did it in one take.
Yep. All right, guys. So it's Cromtober again. It's 2020. We're here at a fire in a backyard.
Undisclosed location.
It's a bit cooler this year than last year.
A lot.
Liking the autumnal feel that we're getting going here.
It was 90 degrees when we did this last year.
Yeah. It's like a legitimate fall coming on.
We had pumpkin spice margaritas last year, if I remember correctly.
That is not my memory, but I'll take your word for it.
So we picked, an oldie and a shorty, but a goodie.
Yeah.
I would think that's at least my perspective on it.
I would agree. Yeah, this is. I've never read this before, even though I've read handfuls of stories by this author.
Yeah, so we're reading Ray Bradbury's The October Game, not to be confused with The October Country, right?
Right.
This is The October Game. We were poking around trying to find publication history for this story. It's a pretty old story. I found some reprint information in the book that I had that sort of tied it to maybe 43. I've already forgot. It was just a few minutes ago when I was looking at it. Were you guys able to find anything?
Well, we did just go through a really traumatic experience.
Yeah.
the October Game, written by Ray Bradbury, published in 1948.
Oh, shit, that was close.
A little periodical that you may have heard of called Weird Tales.
Oh, I've heard of that book.
Yeah, so this is a Weird Tales story, which I didn't know. It is a nice little surprise. It does fit into the Weird Tales kind of twist ending,
yeah,
kind of horror style.
That's why I was excited to talk about it, because it's a little bit Weird Talesy. It's a little bit Twilight Zone-y too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit EC Comics-y.
Very
and
much so. Yeah.
And it's while it's written by Bradbury, I would argue that it's at least it's a little bit Bradbury, but it has a nastier streak than what we normally think about with Bradbury. So there's bits of like saccharine sugar sweetness to it, but there's also this really mean angle to it that it's always stood out to me as an interesting story. So cool. So reading it this year, was this the first time that y'all had read it?
Yeah, I had never read this one before. How about you, John?
Same. Never read it before. Not even sure if I've ever read a Bradbury thing before.
Oh, really?
Cool. Yeah. So I'm interested to hear more about how this differs from his normal output.
Yeah. So this is a little bit different, but it still is of the... I don't know. I mean, it is a typical for, like, an expertly structured kind of short story, which Bradbury, like, he wrote novel-length material, but he was a king with his fantastic and his horror and his science fictional, like, short fiction. Mm-hmm. So this works.
This, to me, reminded me, at least in how punctuated the story is and how it tells this narrative in an economy of words, very similar to Bradbury's story, There Shall Come Soft Rains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is, you know, this really sad story about a fully automated AI house that... yeah, it shouldn't work, but it does. Conceptually, I just don't think that in lesser hands that story would have turned out. But Bradbury is able to make it work, and it's really good.
I agree, man. It's it is a very tight story. It's short. So if you haven't yet read this story and you're listening to this episode, go ahead and hit pause and Google it. It's pretty short. It's like all of 6 to 12 pages of a PDF that mm-hmm. you can find if you just Google October Game Bradbury. There's at least a handful of different options that are out there in terms of written versions of it. There's also some audio versions that you can find as well. So it's pretty easily accessible online, I think, through like legal means. I think this is a story that's been reprinted a variety of ways and it's out there. But we can talk about maybe what it's about here in just a minute and get into the meat and potatoes. Do we want to do any kind of one thing things, guys? Do we have any autumnal spooky stuff we want to talk about?
Absolutely.
Lead us off, dude.
Me?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, my spooky thing for Cromptober Episode 1, 2020. Is the revamped Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh, cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Netflix. Yeah. Watched a few of them. I don't think I've quite finished it all off because there's only like 7 or 8 episodes. Have either of you taken a gander?
Ashley started watching it and has watched 1 or 2 of them.
Yeah.
But I was not able to join in on watching that. But there was something about the theme song when I was a kid that would make me run from the room.
And Robert Stack's voice, right?
Yeah, yeah. Robert Stack's voice.
He had a creepy voice, or it was perfect voice for that. But this has no narrator. That's one of the stylistic changes for it. Mm. It's just the story. There's no drapings like there used to be, I don't think. The theme song is still there.
Yeah.
And I guess that if you pay attention at the end, Stack sort of is in the shadows or in the mist or something. but
it's of course he is. Yeah. He's always out there watching.
I've watched through a few of them. Seems really heavy on disappearances and sort of true crime angles, which I think makes sense. That's where a lot of people love to see stuff nowadays, it seems like, if you look at the podcast world. There was one episode that stuck with me that's about a UFO incident, though. And, of course, as we talked about last year, that's not my favorite thing. But it was definitely the creepiest of the Unsolved Mystery episodes that I've watched so far. So check it out if you haven't given it a shot yet.
Yeah. What about you, Josh? Do you have a one thing?
Man, I've been immersing myself in as much October, as much of the October country as I possibly can. And the thing that I want to share with you guys is a podcast that I've been really enjoying that is set in a fictional Appalachia, a Lovecraftian Appalachia, if you will, that is called Old Gods of Appalachia. And I've told you guys about this show, and we've maybe talked about it before. Have either of you taken a listen to it yet?
I need to get a road trip under my belt so I can listen to a few of them.
Yeah, similar.
Yeah, they're short. They're 20, maybe 30 minutes.
Okay.
And I think that there are two seasons worth of it, so you could easily binge it all in a good long car trip or two. Okay. I listened to it on the Mountain Parkway, which takes you from Interstate 64 around about Winchester down through into the Cumberland Plateau, into the mountain of eastern Kentucky. And it's set in a fictional town called Barlow, Kentucky, in this upside-down Appalachia, where there are older, meaner things walking the mountains and the hills and the hollers than any ghost or haint or spirit your mamma might have told you about. And I dig it. I dig it a lot. The voice acting team is wonderful. The narrator has a great voice. I don't think he's from Kentucky. He makes a lot of reference to North Carolina. But that similar storytelling style infused with what we're accustomed to from like Weird Tales, Lovecraft and Howard and Smith sort of weird fiction. Man, it's just so good.
The driving on the Mountain Parkway enhanced the experience.
It was foggy
and
overcast and so listening to the narrator talk about the things that lie below the mountains.
Nice.
Man, just it was great.
Very jealous of your experience.
It was great. I think just driving down the Mountain Parkway listening to that was it was just the right ambiance for it.
But, nice, man.
Yeah, so I would recommend that wholeheartedly, and you get a little bit of folk tales and a little bit of Lovecraftian weirdness.
Yeah,
set in the mountains, which is not really a setting that I'm used to for that sort of horror. It's real good. How about you, Luke?
So, I was thinking about what would be like a good Cromtober-y one thing, and so I'm starting to dip my toes into some spooky stories. The main thing that I've been reading here recently is called The World of Science Fiction, 1926-76 by Lester Del Rey. It's kind of like a history of science fiction up until 76 when Del Rey kind of checked out of the scene. And so that's been like the thing that I've been motoring through. But the other thing that I've been starting to pick up, and it was principally because of the story we're reading here for this episode, is the World Fantasy Awards Volume 2. So I think I talked about Volume 1 in the Manly Wade Wellman season, but these are two books that came out that are anthologies of horror and sort of fantasy, I guess dark fantasy, weird fiction, from the first handful of awardees of the World Fantasy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second one is, something that was edited by both Schiff as well as Fritz Leiber, which is, of course, a name that we've talked about. And so within that are a wide variety of stories, one of which is the October Game, which is apparently something that Bradbury recited on a Halloween weekend during the first World Fantasy Award. That's kind of the story that's told at the foreword of that.
That's so cool.
But there's just a lot of really good fantasy and weird tales of the time, and that's the thing that I've started to read, because I finished up the first one during the front end of the COVID apocalypse, but at this point I'm kind of starting to read the second one, and I think that's what I'll be trying to read through, just because it's a multi-author anthology. Over this month I'll be able to sort of read along with that, and hopefully maybe, I don't know, like, we're gonna do a couple other Cromtober episodes, at least one more, if not a couple, so I can kind of report back what other spooky stories I get into with it. But it's a good thing, and it's kind of the main, like, spooky thing that I've gotten into at this point.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Cool.
That's three things.
Yeah. You mix them all together in a strange cauldron, and guess what?
You get a Halloween mecca.
Bubbles in it brews. All right, I'm going to put more wood on it. Is that okay?
Yeah.
So we'll liven it up, and then...
Word.
All right, guys. I had to stoke the fire for a moment. My ferocious hound dog may have just came outside, but he's going back inside.
It's a hail hound.
Yeah. My hail hound is more of a couch hound. As it were. All right. Do we want to talk about the story?
I'd like to.
That's usually what we do.
That's how we do.
Yeah.
This story messed me up. there is a twist in the story that I guess we'll talk about later, so spoiler warning. But I thought one thing was going to happen, and another thing happened, and I had to reread the last couple of paragraphs. Because I was so shocked by it.
Yeah,
it has. And the first time that I read this story, I had the same kind of feeling that I think that you might have had, Josh. Like, I had to go back and essentially reread passages, too, to make sure that I was interpreting things, I think, as I should have. And I was wondering, at least on that first go-around, if there were, like, different ways that you could interpret the story. But in subsequent listenings and readings and thinkings, because I've read this story, I think, over the past three Halloweens. I first encountered it a couple years back. It's a nasty one. Ultimately, I don't think there's any way around that interpretation of things.
For sure.
Yeah, it's horrific, and so it's. John, you mentioned that it's kind of Twilight Zone-y. Maybe you said, Luke, that it's Twilight Zone-y. This, to me, like the EC Comics connection is stronger, like the Tales from the Crypt sort of connection, because of just how mean the story is.
Right. Yeah, and there's not necessarily a justification for how the dad is. He just is a bad person.
He clearly has some issues, some mental issues, right? And I'm not certain if he's a psychopath or a sociopath.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's really a clear distinction there, but he lacks any kind of empathy for other people other than himself. And he feels really poorly about his own station in life, right?
It felt very 1950s America to me. Like there's a repressiveness to this story of you're trapped in the wonderland of suburbia. Like even he's sort of talking about that at points. Like he's the host of this child party or this party for kids, and ostensibly on the outside he's happy-go-lucky suburban dad who's maybe had a couple of tough goes with business, but there's a real darkness hiding inside of him, and I couldn't figure out if it was always there or if it was the result of his unhappiness with business and with having a daughter rather than a son. It is ugly though.
Yeah.
And he mentions repeatedly like his loveless marriage with his wife, right? Like he makes the assumption, because this is all told from his perspective.
Right.
He makes the assumption that she is afraid of him, and he kind of takes delight in that.
He's a sadist, man. Where like at the outset, where he chases her around the various portions of the house.
Yeah,
that is like that's disturbing. That is not normal in any sense. That is somebody that is malicious. Like, yeah, like that's the best. Like, that's the word that's coming to mind. Like, that's about right. He is malicious and malevolent. Like, he is being evil.
Yeah.
So we're kind of hitting around the story in terms of a synopsis. We have a family unit of three, and it's sort of 1950s America. Seemingly, that's kind of what we sort of pin it, but it's actually like 1948, right? That was the publication year, and it seems to be about time appropriate. But that kind of initial, like young boomers as elementary school kids, Halloween party ensues with a dysfunctional, or at least like estranged, like mother father combo, and a horrible Halloween party ensues.
Well, it's great, a great Halloween party until it's suddenly not.
Yeah. So, do we want to talk about like specific items of the story or plot points? Do we want to do that? Like go sort of around Robin and talk about like things that we really liked about the story? Would that be helpful? Can we do that maybe?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Okay. So
I'll go. So I think that part of what you mentioned is one of the things that really clicked with me was it's 1948, 1949 sort of era. We're supposed to be in this post-war bliss. Right, like everything is hunky-dory, America's taken off, and I'm very intrigued by the fact that Bradbury wrote this story at that time that kind of shows the dark heart of the suburban dream, maybe, and has that darkness inside of it and the ugliness inside of it that we've hinted at. So that was definitely something that clicked with me upon my read-through. How about you, Josh?
I was thinking that whole, like, what are your neighbors like?
Right, yeah.
Like when I walk Sassafras through the neighborhoods and you walk past these houses where the blinds are always closed no matter what.
Right.
And, you know, are they mutants? Are they vampires? Like, are they conducting rituals? Should I call the cops? Do they have someone captive in there? That whole suburban horror thing is pretty interesting. To me, the interesting part of this was looking at the guy's psyche through his own reflections on things. Mm-hmm. And he always justifies something. He wanted a son so badly, and his wife didn't even want kids. And what did she give him? This daughter.
Right.
And what does she do? She loves it. Like, right. How dare she? It's just so scary.
Yeah.
Because it is 8 years or more of this guy just building up this hatred inside, and you can tell that he has these kinds of conversations with himself all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I like how it's a story almost within his head. Like you talk about, you see his own reflections, you get his own like perspective on things. He's almost sympathetic in a lot of regards. So, like, one of the things that I like about this story, and I've read not all things Bradbury, but a lot of, like, Bradbury's main stuff.
Mm.
Like, Bradbury is known and oftentimes gets a bad rap for being a little bit too on the nose with, like, the coming of age, like, the sickly sweet kind of flavor of things. And I think that I don't necessarily even think that kind of hard criticism is merited to Bradbury, even in his most saccharine stories. I think that it's, I think oftentimes that that's really beautiful, the same way that like a Stephen King Stand By Me or It story is really beautiful. It's like the coming of age is part of the story and the loss of innocence is part of the story. But
like a Spielberg movie kind
of? Yeah, yeah, and Spielberg too. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Spielberg, or even in a more contemporary vein, like Stranger Things, like the reason that that's a thing within the world, and like that's part of it, like that kind of moment in time that we all yearn to be back to just for a few moments, kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's Bradbury, man. Like that's his jam. Like he taps into that greater than no other author as far as I'm concerned. But this story, you get that plus the view that this dude is a straight up monster. And so like the moments where he talks about like that October feeling where he's like laying on the ground outside his grandmother's house, like in a pile of leaves, and he just feels like he needs to cry. Like that's the preamble to the October Country. Like that is what we all feel during that autumnal point in time, and that, like, those are the beautiful moments. Like we all can relate to that, and we can relate to this monster, right? Like on that front, like at least in terms of how the world is turning and the feelings inside. And so I like that the monster or the bad guy, I like that we're that protagonist, if you want to, or we're like at least that like focal character, and that he's at least on like an emotional level sympathetic. Because even like while it's petty, a lot of the complaints that father figure dials in, I mean I can have relation to that, like as a dude that's 38 in 2020, I can relate to a lot of the peeves that, you know, Mr. Wilder reports on. You know, I'm not a monster, and I don't want to like do what he does, but I can at least like associate with like his feelings on things in a lot of ways.
Okay. Well, I, now that you mention it, that part where he has the memory of being in the leaves on the ground in front of his grandmother's house is kind of his loss of innocence moment, right? Like instead of a normal kid who might be, you know, kicking leaves or playing in the crisp breeze or even, you know, who knows what, indulging in like Halloween type stuff, like getting psyched for trick or treat. You know, right. This kid is thinking about the coming autumn as the precursor to winter, and that's death symbolism, right?
Right.
So he is at an early age, like seeing beyond the superficialness of what the season's changing actually means.
None more goth than this guy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he goth
is,
levels.
He's proto goth. Yeah, yeah.
His goth level is over 9,000.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys what Halloween or October rituals you have done or partaken in as kids, or even maybe into your adult lives. Have you done this Halloween game, this October game?
So I've been to I can distinctly remember two Halloween parties in my childhood. One of them was at a friend's house, and I remember the bobbing for apples, and there were caramel apples there, and that was the first time I experienced caramel apples and thought that was pretty much the bee's knees. That's a cool thing to have to eat. And then the other thing that I remember was with Cub Scouts. I wasn't in it for very long, but we had a Cub Scout meeting, and we did this exact game where in the story they're all led into the basement, and they're told that they're going to pass around these bowls, and they're going to hear the story of a witch that they get to touch parts of her body. And I remember one of the den mothers set it up, so we got cold spaghetti passed to us, and we were told that it was her hair, her guts, and then there were eyes, and those were grapes. And Josh and I were talking about this before, but I can't remember if they were peeled or not. And they, you said, to. They'd have to be peeled.
I think they'd have to be.
Yeah, yeah, you're probably
or,
right.
Or maybe like left out and let
halved or
something.
I remember those two things for sure, doing that at that party.
And it wigged you out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, so, yeah, I was the kid that I freaked out. I didn't want to do it. And it wasn't so much that I thought it was really a witch. I just really don't like touching cold spaghetti and stuff. Sure. So I got made fun of. I remember that, yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's just...
You're over it now.
I'll talk about it at therapy or something.
Breaking back these repressed memories.
No, it's...
Oh! Doc!
Doc, let's knock the microphone over.
Doc, go!
Yeah, straighten it out so it's pointed.
Get... Apologies, listeners.
My
scaredy hound. He was a couch hound. Now he's a scaredy hound. is slinking around the fire, but went underneath the...
Here he comes again.
The lines. Yep. I think he's looking for a hot dog, honestly.
How about you, Luke? Have you done any of the bobbing for apples or divinations that you can do on Halloween?
Man, so I gotta be honest. Like, so when I grew up, trick or treat was the end all be all event. Like, there was like in class Halloween party type activities when I was a youngster, and then there was trick or treating, but where I grew up, you know, in Western Arkansas, trick-or-treating was something that happened where you would drive to, like, various folks on county roads to go to, like, specific family members' houses, and then we would end up in, like, the downtown of, I say downtown, the central nucleus of, like, my hometown, like, a hometown of, like, 410 people, because that was the population sign the entire time that I grew up. There was probably 20 or 30 houses of various, like, older folks that lived in town, and we would do the classic trick-or-treating. So, like, Halloween was one of my happiest times of the year, but it totally was framed around trick-or-treating.
Right.
There were some hayrides that happened related to church services, but that kind of stuff also, like, kind of tied into like choir stuff or not choir, but like singing Christmas carols at the nursing home for like Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
It was more that kind of thing. Like, there were a handful of hay rides, but it was all about Halloween. So I never did the witches, like feel the witch's head and play the October game.
Mm-hmm.
So I never experienced that as a kid, but as a grown up, that's absolutely like something that I want to do. And so over the past couple of years with my little guy who's 5 now, I think over 2 years of having like little youngsters over to the house one afternoon, I've done like Jell-O in the bowl and the wet spaghetti noodles, and I love it. And like here in a couple of years, I want to be the weirdo dad that has like the fog machine in one room of the house, and also like wearing, you know, like
your devil costume.
Bella Lugosi, like devil like tarot reader like materials, and I want to do like tarot readings and like have a pentagram out in the yard.
I want you to do that, but I want you to be Gary Oldman Dracula instead. Like old Gary Oldman Dracula.
I love this is a side note. We can put a pin in this. Maybe we can circle back around to it in another conversation. But trunk or treats are like the devil, and I think that they're the stupidest, like, non-Halloween-y thing in the world.
I think this is a good thing to talk about, because our theme this year is kind of like Halloween traditional stuff.
Okay.
And I 100% agree. Trunk or treat is evil.
Trunk or treats are dumb and antithetical to Halloween.
Absolutely.
On the basis of Halloween is both scary yet a sense of community,
mm-hmm.
and trunk or treat is the exact opposite of I can't even trust myself to walk around my neighborhood at night and knock on my neighbor's house and get candy. So I'm gonna like go to a spot that is safe, even though it's the trunk of a car, and who knows what that trunk like this story demonstrates. The person next door, the Mr. Wilder, everybody thought he was normal,
right?
But
he was so quiet.
He was so and guess what he does?
Yeah,
you know, like this is that kind of cool story for that. But I don't know.
I hate trunk or treat. I think it's the worst, because like you said, Halloween is, it's a time of fear, but it's also a celebration of overcoming your fear.
Yes.
And being a part of something more, and like going out and exploring and being curious and overcoming that initial fear. Because it is scary to go around in your neighborhood, even if you're from a town of 410 to 5,000. I don't know, the range for us is pretty big. I know in our numbers mm-hmm. where we grew up at, but yeah, the trunk or treat idea of just, I'm so afraid that I have to build this little bubble that we can all go, that this one select group of people that I know can go to.
Dude, that's it. Yeah. And so my little town of like 400 people, I don't know, because I've not been there in a while. I haven't been there since last like holiday season because of the COVID stuff. Normally I would do like a summer trip, but aside from that, I wasn't like haunting the old like doorsteps of the religious establishments. There was a Baptist church and right. a Methodist church and a Church of Christ, and that was about it in my hometown. But I guarantee you there is a trunk or treat going on in my hometown on the reg
in each every of those year three church
like
lots.
At least for a couple of them. One of them, there's not even like any young people to have kids, right. But that's a sad little note to put a pin in that, but to come back around, but like trunk or treats are the norm now, even in the smallest of towns. How sad is that? Like, I grew up, I did not even necessarily like have that many houses to knock on, but I knocked on all of them. There were certainly some normies and some weirdos.
Right.
Like, I don't know who those people were, because right. I was a youngster and I was just asking for candy and everybody was gracious and cool.
Yep.
Like, the idea of razor blades in a Snicker bar is a silly, like, fallacious, like, nonsensical thing. Yeah, it's interesting that this is an item that has popped up.
I agree.
Yeah.
Josh, any hard feelings about trunk or treats?
I have no stance on trunk or treats.
We got invited after
but,
we had
but you guys have convinced me that I hate them.
Hot take from the Crowdcast, October 2020. Trunk or treats are the worst.
I completely agree with the central thesis of your argument that it is supposed to be a time of wonder and this ritual sort of that is sanitized by the trunk or treat.
Right. It's an embracing of fear.
That is exactly it.
We're so afraid that we have to build our little safe house for.
Yep, you cannot even trust your neighbors. Right. You have to go to whatever sponsor-y has your trunk or treat to go get your candy. It's anyway, trunk or treat's the devil.
Yep.
Mr.
Wilder would have definitely had a trunk or treat.
He would have run over some kid.
Yep. Fitting right in there, yep. Just being fine.
I rarely trick-or-treated when I was a kid. Mom took me a couple of times, but it was a similar thing where, like, we would have to drive around for about an hour.
Yep.
So it's all in the car because we live in a really rural area and we're driving to all of Mom's friends' houses, yep. You know, across the county. So it's not really quite the same. But as an adult, I love trick-or-treat night. And I love seeing all the kids come up in their costumes and handing out candy and, like, dressing up myself and just being a big kid. It's super
yeah.
fun. But as far as, like, the Halloween game, I've never done it. I've seen it on, like, The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, and so I'm familiar with it. But, no, I want to do this whenever you do it for Ben and his friends. I want to bring Avery June so she can get creeped out by
yeah,
it.
Yeah, man.
Too.
Oh, I thought you were just gonna say you wanted
no,
to dress as
you
Optimus
guys,
Prime
like,
and sit in.
Oh no, you two can. You're gonna have to put the blindfolds on. You're gonna have to like sneak in and like put your hand in the ooey gooey.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's yeah, man. I love the idea of the sense of community and the close feeling that you get at that end of the year and into the winter, but yet the scariness of it. I mean, this is like the Walt Disney Legend of Sleepy Hollow, like Halloween party, but also the same thing that's like in the any iteration of the Christmas Carol and like folks dancing around with the Ghost of Christmas Present. Like,
right.
Like, it's that kind of juxtaposition, which is what it means to be, like, a person. Like, mm-hmm. a finite individual that is...
Ephemeral,
and you only got so much time. These are the things that both... that make it meaningful.
Yeah.
It seems like we've had a very different reaction to the ephemeral nature of human existence in the autumnal experience than Mr. Wilder, though.
Yeah, Mr. Wilder takes out a lot of aggression.
Yeah.
And he does it on a subject that I was not prepared for him to do it to.
So can I ask what you thought was going to happen?
Well, I thought he was going to end up killing his wife.
Okay.
Somehow. Using this game as a diversion.
Okay.
And then framing somebody else so that he could get away with the daughter scot-free.
Okay.
Which, I guess that's what I thought was going to happen. What about you? What did you think was going to happen?
I keyed in pretty early that the daughter was going to die.
Okay.
And that it was... I thought it would be slightly different, I guess. I thought it would be more about punishing the mom, the wife, directly, rather than... suckering a whole group of children in and making them a part of this terrible experience.
That is the crazy thing, is like he at the very last, like, he's been talking about his sweet revenge on his wife for, you know, two or three pages, and then suddenly it's like, well, I'm gonna screw these kids up too.
Everybody is an accomplice, or at least like an abettor to this situation. Like, everybody is gonna remember the horror of when the idiot flipped the light on. Like, whatever that was.
This is definitely a big trauma episode, and it's also one of those things that you could see being... It could be like the jumping off point for that movie Trick or Treat.
Yeah.
Like, this is something that seals the deal on a haunted area, or sears this into the psyche of the community to the point where everybody's ruined forever and they never recover. It's a very bad experience that he sets up.
He's a butthole, man. Like, the first time that I read it, I missed the little nods to, like, how he has, you know, the daughter doesn't speak. Is her name Marion? Is that right? And Louise is the mom. Like, he has the exchange with her about, like, what Halloween costume that she's choosing, and it's the skeleton, and it's just right because it's so macabre, it's totally fitting. There's all of these little nods to what he's going to do, but it's all about, like, this hatred that he harbors for the wife.
Mm-hmm.
It's mean, man. Like,
it's very mean spirited. It's a mean, mean story, but it's effective. It's horrific. So, kudos, Mr. Bradbury. You screwed me up.
So, what else do we need to talk about with the story?
Well, what about with the story? I guess this is a tangent, so I'm going to save mine for last.
Okay.
Okay.
You got something?
Is there anything... I like how this story plays out. This is just how my mind works these days with, like, teaching across, like, a variety of different, like temporal scales. Like, it very much focuses on, like, autumn as a season, and it talks about autumn as an entity, and then it zeroes in on the events of a single day and a night, and so there's this focus on, like, exactly how the party plays out. And I like almost the little TikTok that Bradbury provides for how Wilder provides entertainment to everybody across the various hours of the party, and, like, how tension is sort of, like, ramped up over the course of the narrative. I don't know if that's a major talking point or if it's just, like, accolades for, like, story structure. Like, just the way that it starts big, like, talking about the season and the years. And, like, at one point, he talks about Wilder talking about, like, this year he just can't he just can't take one more winter. You know, there's been other winters where they've done, like, some sort of away vacation, or there's been, like, some respite. Like, they know that he knows that spring is coming, and that makes things tenable. But this time around, he's just all out of steam. And so I like how it starts big, but it narrows down into the events of, like, a single night. And it ultimately comes down in the final, like, frantic, sort of frenetic last few paragraphs about, like, a single moment when the idiot turned on the light, right? Right. Like, that's what it's building up to, but there's this, oh my god, like, that is just ramping up of tension. It's redundant.
And even the setting plays into what you're talking about. We start out in a house and rooms, funneling down into the basement, into this confined space.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's perfect. It gets down to the heart of the matter, even, right? Like, they descend down.
They're in his heart of darkness.
And he quotes Dante, right? When they go down in there, like, abandon hope, all ye who enter. Yeah. Like, that, they are literally descending into hell.
Yeah. Dude, that is, I didn't even think about, like, the sort of, like, the symbolism of the house and where they were going, like, the root, the basement, the heart of all of the matter. That's awesome. Yeah.
Good job, Ray Bradbury.
Good job.
Way to go, dude.
It's like he probably thought about all these things.
He probably put some thought into it.
Yeah.
He was probably, like, a master storyteller.
We've heard of him before.
Imagine him reading this, though, and hearing it, hearing the voice of this character as he intended,
uh-huh,
and the pace of it building toward the end. That would be something. I wish there was a recording of that somewhere.
That would be cool, man. Like, at one of the first, I mean, there were varieties of decades of, like, fan conventions that were playing out, but the first, you know, like, the initial world fantasy conventions, that would be such a cool thing to have been, like, a party to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, passing the torch. Any other final items? John, did you have anything else before we get to Josh's, like, postscript or, like final bit?
I guess the only other thing that I thought about was the ending, where I wondered, it seemed odd to me that he says that an idiot turned on the lights, because he seems to have delighted in what he's done, but it almost seems like it's spoiled for him at the end. Like, he didn't want everybody to be a party to it. It was meant for the wife. And he didn't want everybody to see it. He wanted her to know and see it. So I was just trying to figure that out when I read it. He's an evil person, though, so it doesn't really matter what his intention was.
What do you think, Josh?
Well, I think that he must have had some plan. Like, this guy looks at everyone who's not him, and they are idiots, right? Like,
good point.
He's the only person who knows what's going on.
Right, yeah.
And so, because he's such a psycho, I think that he had in mind some sort of grand reveal, probably, for the wife to end up holding all of her little girl's body parts or something at the end. And then
it got spoiled.
And it got spoiled because some idiot.
You're right.
Like, and think about that statement, just how mundane that statement is.
Uh-huh.
Like,
some
idiot cut me off. Yeah, you know, some idiot ruined my daughter's murder plan attempt to make my wife an insane person.
Right.
Like, it is a chilling ending.
Yeah.
And that sentence, that statement at the end, is a great punctuation mark for it.
So I feel similarly that's exactly like the note of, like, hey, who took the arrow to my sails? This was it. I think, though, like, my interpretation of it is that everything that he has been excited for and looking forward towards is happening because, like, the wife is frantic. Like, he's relishing hearing her freak the F out. And I think that he just wants to prolong that high.
That's right.
Like that, like the way that he's saying, you know, some idiot turned out the light or turned on the light. Like, he could have drone it out for another 30 seconds, 60 seconds, 90 seconds, whatever that unit of time. that's like his sort of like headspace was that. But it's entirely like a selfish endeavor. He just wants to see other people hurt. He wants to see her, like the wife, Louise, hurt. It's just monstrous, man.
Yeah, yeah, he's a monster.
So, it's a weirdo story. it is not a prototypical Bradbury story, but it is a fun or like spooky and suitably like discussable like Cromtober story.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Doc, come on, pups. My wide-bottomed lazy hound. I think I've changed his breed like five times over the recording.
That's okay.
Now he's a big bottomed hound.
Fat bottom.
He's out of bottom way. Hounds make the world go round.
Yeah.
Here.
You hear that, puppers? You hear that, puppers? Yep. So we like the story.
We
had issues with the story. Is there anything that you would quibble with or that you would fault it for? Anything like that?
No, I also would be kind of judicious in terms of who I recommended it to. I don't think that I would necessarily recommend this for Ashley. even though I did spoil it for her and told her the ending when she asked me how the story was.
Mm-hmm.
And she gasped. So... You know, I think even in summary, it's a shocking story.
Right.
I don't have any quibbles. How about you?
No, it was tight.
Yeah, I think it's tight. Yeah. I think it's good. I love this story so much, but it is legitimately horror. Like, it is not just a ghost story. It's not just a spooky story. It is legitimately, I think, a horror story.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
That is what it's going for. It's not like a creep factor. It is a... There's a level of, like, the macabre and the horrific that's just, like, embedded in it that's... It's different than just talking about, like, the inevitability of death and ghosts on the doorstep. Like, there's a streak of mean to it that's part of it, too.
Yeah, it's a shock at the end. It's definitely a shock.
Cool. That's a little bit of Bradbury. It's a Bradbury joint. It's an October game. If you want more Bradbury beyond the October game, read the October Country. It's kind of the best short story synthesis of like the Bradbury spookiness, I would say.
And Something Wicked This Way Comes, if you want a longer form.
Absolutely.
Creeptastic October kind of story.
So I've never read The Halloween Tree. That's the other
I haven't either.
That's another novel that I want to get my hands on, but I really do like more now. I love Something Wicked This Way Comes. That's cool. There's a lot to that. Dark Carnival, yo. Woo-hoo. What do you think, John?
I don't know. Carnivals are scary.
Are you down with the clown, John?
I'm not. I do not like the clowns.
That feels like a good place to end.
Yeah. So that's the end of our first Cromtober 2020. This is a long, delayed, kind of drawn-out thing. But bottom line is, you'll get at least more 2020 Cromtober. Hopefully you're making it safe. You're making it sane. We're with you guys. That's it. Josh, how can the guys and gals find us?
You can email us at thecromcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter @thecromcast. We're also on Facebook. But screw Mark Zuckerberg. That's right. Screw you, Mark Zuckerberg. And Instagram, also Mark Zuckerberg. Also, yeah. See previous statement. Call us.
He would chop a kid up and pass them around.
Yes, he would. And probably has.
Yeah.
You could call us 859-429-CROM and share with us all the things that have horrified you in your developing years during the Halloween season.
Yeah, we love hearing about spooky traditions. Hit us up.
Yeah. Yes. Drop a line, yo. And we'll see you a little bit further down the road through Kromtober.
Yeah. The spooky road. We're moving on down at Autumnal.
Moving on down.
That country road. That spooky road.
All right.
That's a good way to fade out.
I think so, man.